Good evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Stephen F. Freeman. Freeman has a PhD from MIT's Sloan School of Management. He's on the faculty of the University of Pennsylvania's Center for Organizational Dynamics, where he teaches research methods and survey design. He is the author, along with Joel Bleifuss, of the book, Was the 2004 Presidential Election Stolen? Exit Polls, Election Fraud, and the Official Count, published by Seven Stories Press in June. I'm talking to Steve Freeman by phone from his office in Pennsylvania. Steve Freeman, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Now, I wanted to ask you, what was it that first caught your attention regarding the 2004 election results and actually motivated you to begin this investigation?
Right. Normally I'm not that political, but I was watching this election quite closely. I was following some things that I found kind of surprising in the polls. And then on election day, I actually had expected Kerry to win and had heard on the exit polls that he won a resounding victory. And went to work that day. I actually drove in the afternoon because I was teaching in the evening. And when I came home, was sat down to watch TV and was surprised to see results that differed dramatically from what I'd heard earlier in the day. And then I went to look on the computer. I was actually watching the results and looking on the computer at the same time.
I was doing the same thing that night, yeah.
Right, and they showed dramatically different stories, and I was just shocked at how they could be so different. In Pennsylvania, for example, they were calling it was too close to call on TV, whereas according to the exit polls, it was a resounding Kerry victory. Florida was too close to call according to the polls, but a convincing Bush victory on TV. So, and in every case, the discrepancy favored George Bush. So, anyway, kind of surprised about that. And actually, at first, I was looking primarily on the computer, and I kind of announced to the room, there were about 10 people there, said, it looks like Kerry won. And they said, well, that's not what they're saying on TV.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, there was that discrepancy, and I'm just was mystified how the exit polls could be that far off. For your listeners who don't really know, maybe have never thought about what an exit poll is.
Just going to ask you, explain what it is exactly.
Yeah, it's really quite different than the polls with which they're likely to be familiar. A typical telephone poll, it's analogous to trying to predict snowfall several days in advance of a storm. Whereas an exit poll, it's really just like measuring, putting your beakers out properly and recording what has happened. In a telephone poll, you have to worry about first contacting voters, which is difficult now because 10% of voters don't even own a landline telephone poll, and then large percentage of the remainder are not likely to be home or won't answer the phone in the evening when the pollsters are likely to call. Then you have to worry about whether or not they're actually going to show up to vote. And finally, you have to consider that many people may change their minds.
Mm-hmm.
Exit poll, none of those problems exist. Again, it's just a matter of, getting a representative sample and recording your numbers accurately.
So let's go back for just one second, though. Exit polls are when people have left the voting booth and have already voted, and you ask them to fill out a form. Is that how it works exactly?
Yeah, you ask.
And they can be anonymous, right?
Right. It's purely anonymous. The interviewer actually just gives the voter a form, a questionnaire, and then the respondent deposits that in the equivalent of a ballot box. So it's completely anonymous. It's not a matter of telling anybody who you voted for. So, people have said, well, maybe people don't want to admit voting for George Bush or things like that. But no, that couldn't apply. It's an anonymous response. So anyway, so I was mystified, to get back to the first question, I was mystified how it could be that far off. And I waited several days for an explanation. nothing came forth. Those that did really made no sense. Something they were saying too many women, but it couldn't be because the pollsters already calibrate the number of males and females that should be responding and take into account the numbers that don't respond.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, none of the responses made sense, just kind of wondering what happened. And then I wrote a paper a week later saying there was this big discrepancy. No compelling explanation or no explanation at all has come forth, and it's something important to understand, either to determine if there's been any corruption in the count or to ensure the population about the veracity of the election.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, so that's how I got involved. And then as I looked into it, I mean, at first I expected there was some reasonable explanation why the poll was going to be off. And I really had no idea of the extent of the problems with the reliability of voting in this country. So for me, it was a shock a day as I began to investigate.
Mm-hmm. And the discrepancies weren't just in a couple of swing states, right? I mean, it was happening all over the country.
Right. The discrepancy happened all over the country, although it's important to... One of the key things we did in an analysis is that it wasn't equally distributed across the country. It did vary by state. All told, it was 7 percentage points, which, you know, to anybody who's worked in these numbers, that's a big number, but it may not seem like that being a number to your audience, but that accumulates to nearly 10 million votes.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than a 3 million vote George Bush victory, which was the official count, the exit polls indicated that John Kerry won by an excess of 6 million votes. So that's a very, very large discrepancy to explain.
Mm-hmm. And let's remind our audience that exit polls have been used around the world to count and verify the integrity of elections in places like Serbia and the Ukraine and so on, right?
Yes. And to me, one of the, like I said, there was a shock a day. One of the many, many astounding ones was that later that very same month, in November 2004, it was front page headlines when there was an exit poll discrepancy in Ukraine, which was, it was almost entirely parallel to the one here. According to the official account, the incumbent won a fairly narrow victory, but the exit polls indicated that, in fact, the challenger had won. And this was front page headlines here, the administration screaming, and Republicans just very vocal in saying that this indicates fraud, that the election ought to be overturned and there has to be a new election. And in fact, that election was overturned. There was a new election. And in fact, the challenger won that election.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And here, it did not even make it into the mass media.
Mm-hmm. And in response to the exit poll discrepancy, the pollsters even came out with a 77-page report? And tried to explain what had happened, and in your book you said you didn't buy it.
Well, yes. The poll also, there were many disconcerting things about the exit poll. Perhaps the most disconcerting thing about our voting system is that it's virtually a black box, especially the newer systems. You push a button, you have no idea what happens inside, and some official numbers get reported. There is no transparency in the process when transparency is absolutely required, both to ensure the public and to verify the accuracy of the process. Unfortunately, the exit polls are a similarly non-transparent process. In fact, we only really knew about this exit poll discrepancy because the numbers were leaked and there was a technical glitch that allowed you and I to see these results that were different from the official count on our computers that evening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because there was a big controversy in 1980 that the exit polls were making people stop voting because they called the election too early, right? So they were a little bit more protective of putting all that out.
Well, that would argue for perhaps not putting it out early, although, well, I don't want to get too deep into that one.
Right.
But yes, the problem always had been that they're too accurate. That they allow the press and the public to know what's going to happen even before they close. This time, it was a different story. They said, well, you know, they're just not accurate at all of a sudden. But what I was saying originally was that the process is not transparent. you know, that not only do they not release the data while the polls are open, they don't release the data at all. Not at all.
Hmm.
And, you know, it was only because of this glitch that you and I knew about this discrepancy. And when I wrote this paper and others clamored about it a bit, they did release a report. They released it many weeks later on Inauguration Eve. And, you know, it was accompanied by headlines that exit polls prove Bush won fair and square, but it does nothing of the sort. I mean, for the most part, it confirms what I had been saying, that there was this large discrepancy, and that, in fact, there are only two explanations for this discrepancy. Either Bush voters, for whatever reason, were not participating in that poll, or the count is corrupted. Now, they just rejected the first out of hand and said what must have happened is that Bush voters were not participating in the polls at equal rates. Now, we do an analysis and for a lot of reasons find that that assumption cannot be substantiated by the data.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I could give you a few examples of why that is the case. One example is if, in fact, Bush voters are not responding at the same rate, then where Bush voters predominate, where you have large numbers of Bush voters, you ought to see overall lower response rates, right? If only 45% of Bush voters are voting, are participating in the polls, then where you have 80% Bush voters, you ought to see much lower participation rates than districts where you have 80% Kerry voters. But in fact, we see the opposite, that if anything, the data indicate Bush voters are participating at slightly higher rates. Response rates were slightly higher in those districts where Bush voters predominated. And there are several such indications similar to this one. You put them together, and it's virtually mathematically impossible that the pollsters' presumptions that Bush voters were participating at lower rates could be true.
Yeah, you explain that more deeply in your book as well.
Right, right. It's kind of hard, especially on radio,
to
describe these things. But yes, we have many, you know, detailed explanation and with the numbers and the visuals.
But you know what? I also want to talk to you about the fact that the exit polls were not the only concern. Let's talk about the important battleground state of Ohio, which was really pivotal in 2004. The Secretary of State Ken Blackwell, like Catherine Harris before him in 2000 in Florida, was the co-chair of the Bush campaign. Tell us a little bit about what you found out about how he used his position to affect the turnout in Ohio and so on.
Right, right. Well, this is fairly well known, the some of his actions to suppress the vote. And there's no question that it was a vote suppression strategy. They know that in many districts, especially predominantly African-American districts, the Democrats and Kerry get the overwhelming share of the vote. And in those districts, you had measures taken like rejected registrations because they weren't on exactly the right paperweight, people misinformed about the polls and the polling process, and finally the incredible misallocation of voting machines such that people at universities and in inner cities would have had to wait 4 to 6, in some cases as many as 12 hours, to cast a ballot.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And obviously that serves to discourage large numbers of people from voting. But we actually make a key distinction between vote suppression and outright fraud. If it were vote suppression, if that were the only factor, I mean, that's happened in many elections, and it continues to happen. Unfortunately, it's almost institutionalized in the system in many ways. And
that was what the Voters' Rights Act was supposed to help alleviate, right?
It is, yeah. And it should, and it shouldn't be permitted. But again, if that were the only problem, then you'd almost have to say, well, they stole it fair and square. And that's, unfortunately, a long-standing tradition.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But the exit polls only account for the people who do overcome the registration hurdles, who do stand in line, who do cast the ballot. So the fact in Ohio there was an 11 percentage point disparity between how people said they voted and the official results in those same precincts. And that only accounts for the people who've overcome all the hurdles of registration and voting.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're saying is that the exit polls and a wide variety of corollary data, which I'll get to in a second, all indicate that, in fact, rather than losing by 120,000 votes in the state of Ohio, Kerry probably won the state by 500,000 votes or more.
You are listening to Out of Bounds. My guest is Steve Freeman. He's the author of the book, Was the 2004 Presidential Election Stolen? So go ahead and continue your thought in regard to this.
Right.
We're talking about Ohio.
Critics have commented on my work and said, well, exit polls are flawed. The exit polls don't really show anything. And the fact that the exit polls indicate a victory doesn't necessarily mean that much. And I even grant those things. You know, I don't think they're true, but even if they were, we never take as an assumption the fact that Kerry won according to the exit polls as indications that he really won. Rather, we analyze this discrepancy and look at the two possibilities, polling error or vote fraud.
Mm-hmm.
On the one side, the polling error is not substantiated. On the other side, vote fraud, there are literally hundreds of indications of election fraud.
Can you name any specifics?
Right. In Ohio alone, which is the only state where there's been anything resembling a thorough investigation, we have instances where ballots are found with Kerry's name covered up by a sticker and Bush's name circled in. That couldn't have happened as a legitimate process on Election Day. Stickers are not allowed.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's clearly after-the-fact tampering. We have other instances of electronic votes where people tried to push the button for Kerry and Bush's name turned up. And it's not isolated incidents. But
this was even reported on the press. I remember these stories.
Right, but it's sort of reported anecdotally, like this happened. Sure, there's going to be some problems when you have several million voters. There's going to be some instances, but this was widespread.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have this secret count in Warren County, Ohio, the largest Republican county in the state, gave Bush his largest plurality. They prevented the public from observing the vote counting process, allegedly because there was a terrorist alert issued by the FBI. The FBI denied issuing any such warning.
Hmm.
So there's little reason to have confidence in the count and
tremendous
reasons to doubt it.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, I also want to talk to you because we don't have all that much time for this interview. In response to the debacle in Florida in 2000, Congress passed the Help America Vote Act, which, you know, replaced punch cards with electronic voting. Tell
right.
us about your concerns about this.
Yeah. This is a case where the cure is 100 times worse than the disease itself.
Mm-hmm.
Electronic voting is just a travesty, and it's hard to convey just how awful a system it is. One way, it's sort of analogous to going and having a red curtain, and you have behind that red curtain somebody who's supposed to transcribe your vote. Rather than you voting directly, you have to tell this person how you want to vote. Now, everybody would be clearly uncomfortable with that system because, obviously, this person, well, he may not hear you right, he may not mark it right, or he may well think that he knows better or, for whatever reason, wants to cast his vote for a different person.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So when you have an electronic voting machine with no other verification, which is what most electronic voting machines are, you just directly record your vote electronically, it's analogous to that man behind the curtain, only the programmers play that role. You're
mm-hmm.
counting on the program accurately recording your vote.
Yeah.
The only real difference between the man behind the curtain is that he can only alter one vote at a time. The programmers can literally change millions of votes by altering master copies of the software.
Yeah, and is it true? I don't know if this is true. 80% of the machines are made by Diebold?
No, but they're made by three different companies, all of whom are interconnected, and all of whom have both close connections with the Republican Party, in particular George Bush, and also histories of fraudulent behavior. In the case of Diebold, there's the famous memo sent out by the chairman saying he was committed to winning Ohio for the president.
Wally O'Dell, right?
Yeah, Wally O'Dell, and he's also a member of Bush's inner circle, one of the people who gets invited to his ranch in Crawford, Texas, and you know, sets the agenda for the nation, and is part of the inner circle of fundraisers. A closely connected company is ES&S. That's the second largest maker of these machines that record and tally the votes. And, you know, almost incredibly, the former president of this company is a U.S. senator, Chuck Hagel. And he won his office immediately upon serving as president of this company. He won a long shot primary victory to get the Republican nomination, and then defeated a popular incumbent senator to win the election in a year that the Republicans, in a very poor year for Republicans, 1996.
It's remarkable.
And it's so little known, but this is the other company. The third company has been involved in several major scandals. They had to pay back the state of Louisiana $14 million for taking kickbacks. These are the three companies to whom we entrust the votes, entrust them to the degree that we don't even ask verification that the votes are recorded as cast.
That's the thing that scares so many people. There's no paper trail at all.
Right, there's no paper trail, but it's not just the paper trail. People think that the paper trail will solve everything, but at the same time, you have to use that paper trail. Even where we do have a paper trail, where we have optical scan systems, where we have other kinds, the paper trail is rarely used, and if anything, it's become more and more difficult to actually conduct any sort of a recount. It just is costly. It takes frequently the threshold is too high. So, for example, if a candidate wins by 5%, frequently the opposition has no recourse to a recount. And in the case of electronic voting, you may have an election artificially set to produce results that come out higher than that threshold.
Now, why do you think the mainstream press has been reluctant to delve further into these issues? Even after RFK Jr. wrote that article in Rolling Stone, that there was a lot of buzz, but there still hasn't been a huge movement.
Yeah, I mean, that's a whole nother book in itself, really, why the media hasn't covered it. And, you know, it's hard to go into it even in a few seconds. There is a good book on this, by the way, that really focuses on that, and that's Mark Crispin Miller's book, Fooled Again. So he talks much more explicitly about the media. We talk about it, you know, I could give the more superficial answer, and that's anybody who's labeled a conspiracy theorist is virtually, you know, unacceptable in either the field of journalism or as an academic, for that matter. Nobody who's called a conspiracy theorist can maintain a job on a major newspaper or can expect to get a faculty position at a major university.
And has writing this book hurt your career?
Well, it's too soon to say.
It just came out in June, that's right. Yeah,
it just came out in June. But, you know, I'm not a political scientist, and to me the lack of any kind of voice in this matter from political science has been just one of the other many shocks. I've been talking with some people. We're trying to arrange a debate with some prominent political scientists. There is one in Cornell who has defended the election, Walter Mebane, who, you know, I would like to...
That's in our neighborhood.
Right, who I would like to have some sort of a panel with. But for the most part, it's been just completely ruled out. You know, just just not even something that can be considered. You know, again, that would be a whole nother show.
Yeah, it would. But do you agree with RFK Jr. in his article where he said that the 2004 election was the most monumental theft in American history?
Right. Well, he kind of bases that on our book. Mm-hmm. So yes, I do concur with that.
Do you? Uh-huh. So what do we do now? I mean, the 2006 midterms are just around the corner. Is there anything voters can do to make sure the election is one of integrity, or at least a semblance of?
Well, there's not that much that voters can directly do. Political parties can do much more in terms of verifying machines, and candidates can do much. There's a good website, U.S. Count Votes, and a woman, Kathy Dopp, who has been developing checklists on exactly this matter. So yes, there are some things they could do. What I'm trying to do is to actually conduct an exit poll that could be used to verify the elections, just like they're used around the world to do so here. And anybody interested in that project, please, I invite to look at our website, electionintegrity.org. And if there's any way they can help with that, we would welcome that.
Mm-hmm. And are you working on any future work in the same lines as the...
Well, we'll see what happens in 2006. I mean, there's a lot of questions that arise from this. One of the... You asked about the media. That's a book in itself. Another is the Democrats. That's a book in itself, too. The two biggest obstacles in getting the word out is... if this is true, why isn't anyone covering it? And the corollary question is, if this is true, how come the Democrats are allowing it? How come they're not contesting it?
Mm-hmm.
And the two kind of play hand in hand. The Democrats don't contest it because they're scared of getting lambasted as sore losers and conspiracists by the media. And the media won't cover it. Every time that I've, in many cases, immediately after the election, I did interviews with... I did interviews with the New York Times, the Washington Post, CNBC, MSNBC, and none of which reached print or were aired. And typically the reason is, well, you know, the Democrats aren't contesting it. You know, we don't think it's, you know, this is something to pursue.
You know, the Democrats have been missing in action on so many issues that one cannot be surprised by this one, I'm
right.
afraid.
So that's another book in itself, too, is the Democrats and their lack of response. And, you know, I actually have spent most of my career, it's interesting to see myself getting criticized as a leftist or just dismissed as a leftist. I've spent most of my life starting up businesses or teaching in MIT, Harvard, and Wharton Business School.
Mm-hmm.
And coming from business, I mean, it's sort of out of field, but at the same time, The configuration of the Democrat and Republican is a very common one in industry. You have a dominant firm and a kind of subordinate firm that is there almost providing an illusion of competition. And if this were an industry, it would be a classic antitrust case that you would have to sue to break them up and allow real competition.
Mm-hmm.
And so you asked what other books or possible works in the work, and that is one. And so, you know, what really is required to have a healthy democracy is a legitimate opposition, and I don't think at present we have that in this country.
Yes. Steve Freeman, we have actually run out of time, so I want to thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me. It was a pleasure speaking to you.
Yes, good luck.
Okay, thanks.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are a project of the Women's Interfaith Institute in Seneca Falls. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And log on to our new website at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.